Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, we're focusing on that handy brain-feeding device, the one that ignites the imagination, informs us of the human condition, and provides opportunities for reflection, the book. Founded 75 years ago by historian Thomas Clark and other Kentuckians, the University Press of Kentucky has published thousands of books about Kentucky history, our music, art, literary traditions, our food and drink, and our politics. Earlier this year, the Kentucky General Assembly killed all state funds for the University Press, which serves the state's public universities and some private institutions as well. Yet, the press is still standing. Proof of that joins us now. Leela Salisbury is director of the University Press of Kentucky. Welcome, Leela.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, as I understand it, you spent 13 years with the press and then on to Mississippi for 8 years with the Mississippi equivalent of the University Press. And now you're back and into your third year in the lead at the University Press of Kentucky. The Great Recession happened on your watch soon after you arrived in Mississippi. And I'm wondering how that experience informed and prepared you for what happened to the press during the 2018 session of the Kentucky General Assembly.
Yes, that was a very formative experience for me. I was drawn to the Mississippi job simply because that was an operation structured in many ways like the press at Kentucky. We are one of very few consortium operations, meaning a press that's aligned with more than one educational institution. And so when I went to Mississippi, you know, I thought, okay, this job is going to be, you know, somewhat familiar. And then I inherited a budget, and 2 months later, the Great Recession happened. And someone at the time gave me the very sage advice of never waste a good crisis. So I think that's what we really tried to do at Mississippi. And, you know, the crisis then, as now, was financial. And I am grateful in retrospect, looking back, because I think the opportunity that we took was to look at making all parts of the operation as efficient as they needed to be, thinking about what was changing within publishing, sort of separate, you know, from the crumbling economy. It was just at the beginning in 2008 of print on demand, which has radically changed how presses are able to use inventory. We don't have to tie up a lot of cash in, you know, books that may not sell for 2 or more years. So it was kind of a deep dive into let's look at all parts of this operation, figure out how we can continue to do the mission that we are here to do and to make that even stronger at the same time that we're figuring out how to cut the budget in some ways and just make the most effective use of new technologies available to us. So, you know, I remember very clearly working with the department heads on that in Mississippi. And when I came back here to Kentucky, that's really the first set of conversations that we had is doing the same kind of thing. And this, honestly, you know, was a year and a half before any of the budget things came up. But it was my sense that, you know, a press or any part of a university needs to be a good steward of the resources that it's given. And I think what the press does is so valuable and so incredible, and I wanted to make sure our stewardship of the resources that let us do that was equally responsible. And so we did a lot of the same kinds of things, looking at, you know, printing and inventory. And in terms of that, the press here was already in really great shape. A lot of what we looked at, too, was workflow and the kinds of staff we had. You know, we were outsourcing a lot of design. And I had the wonderful opportunity at Mississippi to work with 3 in-house designers. And I have to admit, I got a little spoiled by that. Mm. And it was also it brought strength and some operational heft that I felt was valuable. And so that's something we were able to do here that affected both some cost savings, but also brought us some new strengths and capacity. People who love books love the physical book. And that was an opportunity that I saw that, hey, we can be doing even better in this area and provide more service and also opportunities for students. We do work with a lot of students in-house. And that is one of the great joys, seeing my office is right in the front of the building and I see the students walk in and out of the door, and seeing the number of those students increase and also the diversity of those students increase. You know, that's something we've talked a lot about at the press. So I do feel that, you know, nearly all those experiences at Mississippi really translated. And I'm grateful for the fact that a lot of those conversations had been taking place for well over a year before the budget crisis came up, so that, you know, we were really in midstream of doing what we wanted to do to strengthen the operation anyway.
In retrospect, that was quite a convergence of emerging technologies coming at you all at once, at the same time having the bottom drop out with the recession. Has it made a difference to the survival of the press that it's among the few university presses in the country that's actually a consortium? And what does the Kentucky version of that arrangement look like?
I do think it really does help, because one of the things that I think we saw in the political discussions that happened in the spring was just the sheer number of phone calls from places all across the state, not just here in Lexington, but because, you know, we enjoy relationships with universities, you know, from Murray in the far west to Moorhead in the east. People on those campuses and people who read our books were calling in from places all over Kentucky. And I do think that was something that was very important, and also pointed out that we do have a real statewide mission and not just a, you know, a single campus focus. So I think that brought a lot of strength. And the idea of the consortium makes so much sense to me. If you look at the Mississippi and the Kentucky consortium side by side, we are slightly different in that our consortium here at Kentucky does include some private universities and the two major historical societies in the state. And the financial arrangement at Mississippi was a little different. It was started as a consortium press in 1970. So the arrangement there is that the allocation funding, the additional funding for the press, comes from each of the partner institutions, sort of broken out, you know, by their size and what percentage of legislative funding they get generally. So, but that was not the arrangement in the founding of Kentucky. The press started in 1943, actually, as the University of Kentucky Press, and then in 1968, Dr. Clark began some discussions saying, you know, really, this needs to – we all need to work together with these campus partners and make this consortium. So in 69, that was passed, and we've gone that way since. So in terms of the financial discussion – it's a little bit like trying to put a cat back in a bag, which is not the easiest thing to do. But I would argue the consortium brings us incredible strength, not only in just the geographic nature of what we do, but it also brings the press a lot of intellectual heft in that, you know, we are able to deal with faculty at all our campuses very closely. And I've done one of the things I did in the first year and a half here was I did formal campus visits to every one of our consortium partners and, you know, asked them all, what are your pain points in scholarly publishing? What do you want to see the press doing more of? And just the individual meetings I had with faculty and sometimes staff were so heartening. They're fascinating Kentucky regional projects. There was a large mushroom farming operation in Mammoth Cave in the 19th century in Kentucky. You know, I did not realize we've got five different MFA programs in the state. And one of the things we're doing is kind of trying to capitalize on that and do some more creative kinds of things through a special series that we have with Center. So I think being present and interacting with faculty on these campuses gives us so many more important books and projects that we can develop.
Many of the books published by the University Press over the decades have defined what it means to be a Kentuckian.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I'm wondering, and I imagine many who have watched what's happened in the past year are wondering what the impact of these budget stresses are having on your ability to carry forward that tradition.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the conversations that we had when I first came back was, and I think this is a question any organization should ask itself periodically, and, you know, the opportunity of having a new director is always a good chance to ask that question. You know, we sat around a table and said, what is it that this press does the very best? You know, what is it we have capacity for? What are our areas of strength? You know, how do we make that even more effective? And a lot of those conversations then revolved around our publishing in Kentuckian regional history and publishing about Appalachia. This is a moment in American history where there does seem to be a more than ever a laser focus on Appalachia, often not for the things that we as people of Appalachia would like for this region to be known for.
And do I understand that you have a new partnership with the Heineman Settlement School toward that end?
Yes, yes. And so, you know, in having these conversations, we thought, you know, how can we continue to grow this capacity? So reaching out to partners like Heineman who you know, have amazing writers and contacts and people we want to be working with anyway, it just sort of reinforces the idea of the consortium that we are stronger through partnerships. And if there are other ways we can define these partnerships, how can we broaden the kinds of material we get, you know, our editorial reach through key people who are interacting with amazing writers and thinkers and that are focusing on a lot of these questions. So I guess if you're asking if we have less capacity to do that, I will say traditionally the role of many university presses, we are businesses on the one hand. We have to deal with Amazon and vendors and bookstores, independent and chain, just like any other publisher. On the flip side, a lot of what we tend to publish are things that might not sell enough copies, honestly, for a traditional large commercial publisher to take on. And Kentucky is a small population state comparatively within the U.S., and, you know, my fear would be that, you know, if there weren't the outlet of the press, especially for a lot of these rich first studies of primary materials dealing with our history and culture, if the press didn't publish those books, I'm not sure how those books would ever get done.
You mentioned Amazon and so forth, and I'm just wondering, not too long ago, it was predicted that the digital ebook would soon replace the paper version, that it was the death of the paper book that we hold in our hand. E-books have been around for a while now.
Right.
How accurate was that prediction?
Well, it's funny. I joked earlier this year, maybe a gallows humor. I said, you know, the demise of the press has been greatly exaggerated and that, you know, we're still around. And I think the same can be said of the print book. If you look now that what happened was basically the adopters who liked reading on the Kindle and other e-readers sort of maxed out at about 20% of the market. And if you look at, you know, the studies of reading habits of Americans, the e-reader sort of is just one tool they use. It may be something people use when they're traveling or they can't fit, you know, 10 books in a suitcase. But those people often tend to also be people who have a physical book lying on the bedside. Really, what we try to do, and we publish all our new titles in, you know, print and several different kinds of electronic versions. I think we acknowledge that readers want to come to our content through a variety of different ways. They may, you know, be discovering something through a library search engine and want to just look at one paragraph, you know, that they sort of need for a paper or something. But if it's a source they really want to use more in depth, they often will turn to the print book for that and get that copy. So, you know, I'm just trying to make that information easily accessible in as many different formats as we need. But definitely the print book is not going away. And I think some of what we've done in-house and thinking about the kinds of books we want to be publishing, a renewed focus on architecture, you know, arts in Kentucky, some of those very visual books that necessarily need a physical format. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, even in the moment of the ebook, you know, we're doing more of those kind of real print books.
Leela Salisbury, director of the University Press of Kentucky, we thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You have to love irony. Leela Salisbury was actually late for her interview because the truck delivering our next guest's new book had blocked her car. Coming up after the break, University of Press author Dr. James Clotter on the second edition of A New History of Kentucky, which is hot off the presses. So hot, it made Leela late. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. Thank you. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. Abe Lincoln once said, books serve to show a man that those original thoughts of his aren't very new after all. That's especially true of history books. It's time for an update of Kentucky history in all of its complexities. New historical discoveries add facts and layers of nuance, warts and all, to enlightenment about a place and a people, the cultural, demographic, economic, social, educational, environmental, gendered, intellectual, military, political, racial, and religious life of a people and a place. The outcome of this research by state historian James Clotter and Craig Thompson Friend, director of public history at North Carolina State University, is the second edition of A New History of Kentucky, published by the University Press of Kentucky. And we thank Dr. Clotter for joining us. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
How extensive is this update of A New History of Kentucky?
Seemed like it took forever for me. had to update all the statistics for 20 years ago when the book first came out in 1997. And then I had to write a new chapters on politics and then add to chapters everything that happened the last 20 years. It seemed like it would have been easier to start again sometimes. But it's a lot of work. Of course, my new co-author, Craig Friend, he started fresh. He wrote his whole section over. Part of mine, at least, I could keep in. But part of his, he had to start over, and he wrote the whole thing over.
So did you split the book between the two of you? One of you did one half and one the other?
Yes. He did the first half through the Civil War. I did from the Civil War to the present. Mine's a little longer because there's more time frame in there.
And what are we going to find in this new edition that was not covered in the original?
Well, there's a whole new chapter in politics for the last 20 years. Kentucky's politics in that time has changed. Mm-hmm. Somebody said Mississippi's politics believes in a two-party system. They believe in, but they only believe in one party at a time. Kentucky's been the same way recently, so it seems I'd write about that. Also, you see a lot of information, more human elements in there. And his Craig Friend's part, he did a lot of Native American history that we didn't have in the first book, particularly strengths of his writing, I think.
My understanding is that in this second edition, we're going to find fresh insights, different interpretations, and original ideas. And that seems to imply some aha moments in the course of doing your research. And I wonder, did you discover information that called for a significant revision of what might have been considered settled history?
Well, a lot of economic history has changed drastically in 20 years. Tobacco is now not as important as it was 20 years ago. Coal mining is continuing its downward spiral as it was since the 1950s, things like that. Also, the aha moments is the literary history of the state is very strong. We don't stress that enough, I think. Kentucky's got a very strong literary history and musical history. Mm-hmm. Stress that in the book more. Political history, I stress that. In Craig Friend's part, he stressed very much the Native American presence and looking from their viewpoints and what the world is like. Looking east rather than west. We look west from the mountains instead of looking east from the Indian country. He looked east and see what they saw as well. So it's both of us, I think we explore different parts of the society.
Now, the book contains stories of Kentucky personalities that range from the heroic, folks challenging slavery and segregation, to scoundrels. Even America's first serial killers are in there. You and Dr. Friend have recrafted the narratives about these people of our past to make it more accessible. How does that change the reading experience?
Well, history is really about human people, about people. We're all humans on this earth. We all share this earth. It's really about the people in history. I try to make the people come alive. And people like Madeline McDowell Breckinridge, who, a young girl, suffered a loss of her leg, but she could have retreated from the world at that. Instead, she became the leader of the women's rights movement in Kentucky and probably the most important Kentucky woman in the state's history. People forgotten about history like her. People who are not even known in history like Sam Hawkins, a black coal miner from Letcher County who went to mines to dig some coal for his son. His daughter was in college. She needed some money. He went in the mines, dug out money for her daughter. The mine collapsed after he came out. Sent the money, she came back, and she died. And this is a sad story. A literate man who got his daughter through college. But it's a story that we need to hear, too, the stories of there's heroes all around us in our lives.
When I picked up the book, I went to the index first, and I'm betting that a lot of people will do this, and you find your hometown. There's something for everybody in Kentucky in there, isn't there?
Yes. In fact, when I did the first volume, looked at a number of counties, and almost every county in Kentucky was mentioned there one way or the other. And people do that, look there, and sometimes it's not in there, but it's in the text still. But basically, Kentucky's history is a history of all the counties of the state, all the parts of the state, all the people of the state.
In the introduction, I mentioned that in highlighting our past here in Kentucky, you don't shy away from the Commonwealth's warts. What are some of those?
I think we've had a lot of warts. We had slavery, of course. We treated women in second-class status for long periods of time. Child labor in an early period of time. More than that, with warts, there's more violence in the state. Feuds were almost endemic to Kentucky. Feuds gave Kentucky a reputation it's still trying to overcome. Violence in the Black Patch War in the western part of the state, tobacco war is there. Assassination of a governor, the only governor in American history who died in office as a result of an assassination, and things like that. Those are all part of Kentucky's history, and not a very good part of Kentucky's history, things that we need to know about, but we need to forget and move on beyond those, too.
Leela Salisbury of the University Press left us with a question for you, and I'm going to pose it to you and see what you think. It goes like this. In light of Kentucky and its historical prominence in the 18th and 19th centuries, has our lingering rootedness in regionalism prepared us for 21st century challenges? Are we the model for a new America, or are our historical understandings of our identity going to lead us to a place where we're playing economic and cultural catch-up for the rest of the century?
Well, the 19th century Kentucky was a very important place. Between 1824 and 1860, there's 10 presidential elections. Kentucky has ran for either president or vice president 8 out of the 10 times. So it's a very important state. Its population is in the top fourth of the states in population for the Civil War. It's kind of the breadbasket of the nation agriculturally. It's a very important state, but then after the Civil War, it starts to decline in population and importance in the nation. Now, though, its regionalism still is left over from that era. In fact, if you look at Murray, it's closer to the University of Mississippi than it is the University of Kentucky. Northern Kentucky is closer to Canada than it is to western Kentucky. Pike County is closer to the Atlantic Ocean than it is to western Kentucky. So this regionalism divides us sometimes. You know, northern Kentucky is tied to Cincinnati, Knoxville. Southern Kentucky is tied to Knoxville in some ways. West central Kentucky is tied to Nashville. Those are all things that take away from our unity as a state. You know, we stand divided, we fall is our motto, but we're often divided as a state because of those regionalism. Still, though, the things like the University Press of Kentucky are the models that we should be following. It's a consortium of universities around the state working together. We should be following these kind of models and working together, as Henry Clay did in his lifetime as well. Compromise is his format. We need to compromise more. We need to follow his guide more.
I'm wondering if, as an historian, it can become frustrating when people like me, who are amateur history buffs and those of us who are not historians, become rigid in our expectations of the historical record. Is the historical record more of a fluid thing that's subject to expansion and even revision from time to time?
Sure. I mean, there's nothing – well, there's factual history and there's interpretive history. Factual history is the fact that something took place on a certain day, the facts and the dates, the dull part of history in some places' minds. Interpretation of the history is a living thing. It's breathing. It's alive. There's blacks and whites, and there's also grays. Most Kentucky history is gray, in between the extremes of the right and written word. There's a lot of factual information, but there's also interpretations that tell us more about our state, and we interpret our state through its own eyes, through our own eyes and through our own glasses each year. Each day we live, we interpret things differently.
Kentucky State historian and co-author of the second edition of A New Kentucky History, Dr. James Clotter. We thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Last week's edition of Eastern Standard featured my conversation with EKU President Michael Benson about his new book, College for the Commonwealth, A Case for Higher Education in American Democracy. It's just been published by the University Press of Kentucky, and you can listen to the conversation with Dr. Benson on esweku.com. Go to the Current and Previous Programs tab, and you'll find it in the top row of programs there. As we began that conversation, Dr. Benson sidetracked for a moment, mentioning that he would like to make an editorial comment on behalf of the University Press of Kentucky. I saved it for this program.
The press puts out so many great titles, and it doesn't matter what you're interested in. It could be history, political science, nature, agronomy, whatever it is, the press puts out so many things that are a benefit to so many people. That's why I was so disappointed to see that it got its funding cut. And I've been in touch with Leela, and we're trying to – I know they're trying to figure out ways that maybe there can be some shared costs with regard to the institutions that benefit, one of which is Eastern Kentucky. It's the only press that I know of that includes all the public institutions, some privates, and even historical societies that all kind of in the aggregate participate in this press. So I'm not just putting a plug in because they published our book. This is much bigger than us. This is a press that's been around for 75 years. And I don't know too many states the size of Kentucky that have that kind of resource. And, you know, granted, if you take the per capita number of great writers that have come out of here, whether it's Mr. Barry or Robert Penn Warren or any number of others, there's a rich literary and historical tradition in the state that people have valued and appreciated and cherished and nurtured. And the press, I think, is an outward manifestation of that.
EKU President Michael Benson. Dr. Benson, Dr. Clotter, and many other Kentucky authors will be on hand on Saturday at the Kentucky Book Festival in Alltech Arena at the Kentucky Horse Park outside Lexington. If you're listening to our Sunday evening broadcast, the festival has ended, but the books it presented are available. To check out the titles, go to kyhumanities.org and click on the Kentucky Book Festival tab. A finding that flies in the face of a popular critique of millennials that all they consume is internet fluff. A recent Pew Research study found that millennials are more likely to have read a book in the past year than Americans over the age of 30. But the two, books and the web, are not mutually exclusive. There's a corner of the internet where millennials are making viral content that is decidedly bookish. Vermont Public Radio's Angela Evansy had this report for NPR's series New Boom.
When Kanye West released Bound 2 last year, the music video, with Kim Kardashian doing a lot of blinking and bouncing on a motorcycle, became instant fodder for parody. I know you're tired. South Park, Saturday Night Live, but you might have missed this one.
Your eyes get tired from reading a good book on a Saturday night.
Hardcover Bound 2, created by Annabelle Quesada and Lachey Delaney. In place of rhymes about Kim, lines about books.
Uh-huh, honey.
Met my book club on a Wednesday. Brave New World put me in a frenzy.
Quesada and Delaney's first spoof was of this song by Kanye and Jay-Z.
So I ball so hard, my wanna find me.
It all started when Delaney tweeted, "Read so hard, librarians trying to find me."
I tweeted that and fell asleep.
At the time, Lachey Delaney lived in New York, where she got her MFA and taught English.
And I feel like a day later, Annabelle had texted me and said, "I have lyrics, let's shoot a video."
Read so hard, librarians trying to find me. They can't identify me. Checked in with a pseudonym, so I guess you could say I'm Mark Twaining.
You know, we were bookifying everything.
Annabelle Quesada is a freelance filmmaker. She lives in Brooklyn.
So, as an example, Jay-Z shouts out all these basketball players.
Jackson, Tyson, Jordan, Game 6.
We shout out writers.
Burroughs, Golding, Shakespeare, all dead.
Quesada and Delaney aren't the only ones making smart internet content disguised as the more frivolous stuff that floats through our feeds. For the website The Millions, Janet Potter rewrote the titles of classic novels as clickbait headlines.
So, for example, you would see the cover of Moby Dick, but we've taken out the headline that would say Moby Dick, and instead it says, "They told him white whales were impossible to hunt." That's when he went literally crazy. That's actually my favorite.
Potter says content like this appeals to a certain kind of audience.
I think the people who get this post have one foot in both worlds, who are, you know, well-read, very literate, but also are very familiar with today's internet.
These are the people who got in on the hashtag hipster books, created by Grand Central Publishing, and tweeted Remembrance of Things Pabst and The Selfie of Dorian Gray. They're the ones who could decipher the first lines of novels that Slate recently spelled out in emojis, those colorful little icons.
Is it going to get me kicked out of the studio if I say that along with listicles, millennials is my other least favorite word in the world?
That's Isaac Fitzgerald, the editor of BuzzFeed Books. BuzzFeed being the grand purveyor of listicles for millennials.
We don't do reviews so much as we want to be your friend who's like grabbing your sleeve and saying this is the book that you need to read.
Two parts literary pun names for your cat, one part contemporary writing. But Carl Taro Greenfeld is skeptical.
If the idea is that internet users are becoming more educated because they're reading listicles or some sort of BuzzFeed clickbait that is derived from literary content, I think that's a bit specious.
Earlier this year, Greenfeld wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called Faking Cultural Literacy. He says you don't, in fact, have to be well-read to get this stuff. And he worries that reading content derived from books might replace reading actual books.
Rather than encouraging one necessarily to go and investigate the primary source and actually read Jane Austen, I wonder if that's actually convincing people that, well, I don't need to read it because I can build some plausible version of thought about this subject without having to read it.
But if you ask Erica Okrent, the listicle itself is a literary form. Okrent is a linguist living in Chicago. She points out the listicle has a predictable structure, like a limerick or a haiku.
It happens to be most commonly used for dumbed-down distraction, but there's nothing about the fact of a list itself that makes that necessary.
People write poetry on Twitter, so why can't they write fiction in the form of lists? If you're despairing for the end of letters at this point, Isaac Fitzgerald has these words for you.
Seriously? I feel like there's no industry that's more obsessed with its own demise than publishing. But it's been like that since the printing press. I'm sure there were just monks that were like, well, what about our hand-painted letter books? Those were the only real books. This printing press stuff is trash.
The kids might read in a different way, but we still read. One of BuzzFeed Book's most popular listicles, 65 books you need to read in your 20s. For NPR News, I'm Angela Evansy.
I am now marking my page. Don't want a crease on my page.
Coming up after a short break, there's a saying that a good book is one that opens with expectation and closes with profit. That could be said of The Birds of Opulence, in which our next guest, Kentucky author Crystal Wilkinson, examines the forces that shape who we are. And the literary spectrum is broad and accommodates all kinds of ways to present ideas and spark imagination through the written word, and in this case, imagery. It's Richmond's first Rich City Comic and Pop Convention, and Blake Vickers from the EKU campus newspaper Eastern Progress takes us there.
I didn't expect to see that many people in their costumes of superheroes and Star Wars stuff that they liked, although I guess I sort of should have expected it.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. And in this edition, we're talking about that one place where you can examine a fragile thought without breaking it. In a book. Appalachian poet and author Crystal Wilkinson is a living, breathing reminder that you can grow up in the deep woods of eastern Kentucky. Outhouse, no running water, coal and wood stoves for heat. And eventually find yourself in college, EKU in Spalding. And then, drawing on all of that experience, perspective, and education to influence other budding writers at UK, Morehead State University, Berea College, Lindsay Wilson, and Cumberland Universities, among others. Welcome, Crystal.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And that's quite a journey. Where exactly did you spend your childhood?
I spent my entire childhood in Indian Creek, Kentucky, and which is sort of nestled in the Knob region here in Kentucky.
And what county was that in?
Casey County.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did those experiences growing up, being able to run free in the woods, many of us can relate to that, that grew up in eastern Kentucky. How did those experiences shape you as a writer?
I think the biggest thing that shaped me was solitude. You know, mm-hmm. I was about to say loneliness, but more solitude, because I was my mother's only child, and my grandparents raised me. And so by the time I came along, all of their children were gone. And so I was there by myself, and our house sat on about 60 acres. I just had the freedom to imagine and to roam.
Solitude gets a bad rap, doesn't it? It can be mistaken for loneliness.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's also, it can be quite a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's where my imagination was able to form, because no one else was around. And so I spent a lot of time alone pretending, which was part of imagination. And then when I got old enough, it went to reading. And then after that came writing.
As I mentioned, you first went to Eastern Kentucky University. Tell us about that transition from Indian Creek to EKU.
Well, that was an interesting transition, because I had never been away from home, had never been away from my grandparents. Of course, now as a city woman, I was a very country girl, and I considered moving to Richmond, sort of going to the city. And so it was an exciting experience, but it was also sort of daunting. And I sort of move in and out of my accent now like a chameleon, but then my accent was very, very strong. And I recall as a young, I graduated from high school at 16. So there I was at Eastern at 16. And everybody was, even though Eastern Kentucky University, Eastern Kentucky, but people were making fun of my accent, that it was still sort of an anomaly to be African-American and have such a strong twang.
You've done so much writing, but I want to talk about your most recent book, The Birds of Opulence, which came out a couple of years ago, I believe.
Mm-hmm, 2016.
It deals with so many complex issues. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Well, it was a story that the germ of the idea, actually, I had been wanting to write about mental illness for a long time, because mental illness affected my family and affected my mother. So I wanted to address mental illness in women, mental illness in African-American women, mental illness in Appalachian women and Appalachian communities. And I also wanted to address ancestral memory in some way. Like when we move to the next stage of our lives, you know, having been raised or brought up in a particular family, how much of it is in the blood, and then how much of it has to do with decisions that we make as we move forward into the next generation. So I wanted to write about all of those things. And I think I originally thought that some of those themes would appear in another book, sort of in either a prequel or a sequel. But I decided to put them all in the one book. And it took me a long time to write it, but I'm very, very proud of the little novel.
It's a very striking title. What's that about?
Well, the town, Opulence, has become my primary town to write about, the same way that Faulkner wrote about his town that I can never pronounce, Yonatopwa, or Wendelberry's town, or Ernest Gaines's town that they returned to, Port Royal, and I can't remember what Ernest Gaines's parish is that he returns to. So Opulence is the name. And the title, the birds come from a lot of different places. The birds come from actual birds that could be found or could not be found in Kentucky. Comes from colloquial sayings. You know, my grandmother always said, you know, oh, Miss So-and-so, she sure is a bird. So it comes from that. And then there's another layer that deals with sort of culture, sort of reaching all the way back to Africa, and deals with an Akan Ghanaian term called Sankofa. And there's a symbol that they use called the Sankofa bird, which appears on the cover of the book. So all of those things are sort of intertwined in that. So the birds has multiple meanings, so both literal meanings and sort of figurative meanings as well.
You touched on ancestral memory mm-hmm. a second ago and then mm-hmm. and mentioned it there again. Can you tell us a bit about the ancestries that you are exploring?
Yeah, so in this particular book, it's sort of centered around the women. And again, I wanted to, you know, there's one thing to have a certain pathology or a certain dysfunction in a family, in an Appalachian family. And it's another thing to have something that's sort of born of the blood. You know, so they say that mental illness is inherited, but I think dysfunction is perhaps not. And so there's a little bit of both of that these two families have to deal with. And that AKAN concept that I was talking about that comes from Africa says, and I think is a very Appalachian concept as well. It's like you have to know where you come from in order to know where you're going. And so ancestrally, that way, I think these characters are both sort of moving forward with their lives of sort of this legacy of dysfunction, a legacy of mental illness, and trying to decide or trying to work through whether or not they can overcome those things or not.
Something that other writers have very much tried to tackle, Toni Morrison in particular comes to mind, loves to probe the way that our pasts can unexpectedly manifest in the present or condition our lives without our conscious realizing. Can you tell us about how that works in the novel?
I think, you know, and Faulkner said, too, the past is not dead. It's not even really past. I think mm-hmm. that's his quote. And I think that that's what I tried to do to these characters, particularly the younger characters who are there and they're present. And we always try to say, oh, I'm nothing like my mother, or I'm nothing like my father or my grandmother. And then you walk by, you know, not only is it physical, you walk by the mirror one day and you go, oh, how did my mother get there in the mirror? but I think those things can be sort of internalized, too. And it's also in what we say and our habits and our traditions. So while we lose a lot from generation to generation, and we probably can't always create the things that those Irish ancestors or those African ancestors did, I've always been amazed at how much is actually there. You know, in real life and in fiction. You know, one thing that fascinates me about ancestry is how you can look at a photograph, a really old, several generations back photograph, and see this child, you know, this 3-year-old that's present now in 2018. And you can look at a photograph from an earlier century and see the same eyes or the same nose. And so the ways that genes sort of dance through us, I find something that I'm sort of haunted by.
I keep mentioning Toni Morrison, but when she explores characters' personal history, she's often also trying to draw our attention to the ways that our shared national history can be very personal. Is that something that you're trying to draw attention to, for instance, with your exploration of mental illness in Kentucky?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that because of a lot of reasons that in both the African-American community and in the Appalachian community, we don't talk about mental illness. Well, in the larger community, too, you know, in the United States and probably in most of the world, it's one of the last frontiers, I think, that we sort of shy away from. We don't want to talk about it. We're embarrassed by it. It's still sort of a mysterious sort of illness, and we don't talk about it in the same ways that, you know, it's we can talk about a loved one who has, cancer, for example, or some sort of physical disease that ravages them in some ways, but we don't know how to talk about mental illness still. So, of course, yes, in this book, I hoped that would be sort of a rippling effect to sort of like at the heart as author to be talking about my own mother in some ways, even though, you know, she's nowhere in this book, literally. But and to also be talking about my own community as an African-American person, and then to also be talking about the Appalachian community, and then it sort of ripples out into the Kentucky world and then the United States all together. So I hope and I think it has. There are lots of conversations that have gone on a lot of different platforms with this book.
It seems as though that national dialogue about mental illness only becomes robust when we're shocked into it by some event, shootings and so forth.
Right.
And then it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying is we need to be more consistent to keep it up there.
Yeah, we do. And I think that that's the sort of the good work that with my book in particular, that a lot of book clubs have been able to do and to talk about and to have sort of some public conversations about it that I haven't even been privy of, except for them to tell me in letters that they send me or in emails. And so that's been wonderful that it's been able to spark conversations, because isn't it? I mean, I think that's what literature is all about. The book has a conversation with the reader, and perhaps that reader has a conversation with another reader, and it ripples out that way.
Writer, educator Crystal Wilkinson, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There's a lot of room along the literary spectrum for all kinds of storytelling. Blake Vickers, opinion editor for the Eastern Progress, EKU's student newspaper, explored the pop culture variety at a lively happening at Richmond Mall.
It's been a very long time since the term lively could be used to describe the Richmond Mall. However, on Saturday, November 3rd, things were different. The parking lot was full. People of all ages could be seen waltzing in through the gates, where a replica of one of the Jeeps from Jurassic Park was parked beside. Some of these people were seen arriving in costume. Kylo Ren was brooding, the Joker was grinning, and the scantily clad woman with a battle axe was grimacing. It seemed that the once destitute old mall had become a site to a once mocked, but now increasingly mainstream style of celebration. For the first time in its history, Richmond was hosting a comic book convention. The Rich City Comic and Pop Convention had made its debut. For the uninitiated, comic book conventions, or cons as they're lovingly referred to by the nerd community, are a celebration of comics, sci-fi, fantasy, pop culture, and more. This means convention halls are packed to the brim with vendors and visitors. Newcomers can expect booths selling comic books, artwork, collectibles, t-shirts, and a whole other slew of items from nerd culture. As it is a first-time event, Rich City was a tad smaller than the other cons held in Kentucky, like Lexington and Louisville. But that wasn't to its detriment. It meant that it would be densely packed with vendors, and the layout of the event would be neatly organized. And unlike most cons, this one would be for free. Assistant coordinator Wesley Giff spoke at length about Rich City.
Well, this is our first year, obviously, and we thought, hey, if we make it free, then hopefully that'll draw a crowd. We wanted to bring some star power to this event, but yes, we did want to highlight the fact that, you know, this is comic books, this is pop culture, horror, wrestling, you know, et cetera. You know, we wanted to give a good enough blend of those things.
Rich City's origin was another topic Gift covered. From the beginning, he and his associates saw it as an opportunity to make something special for Richmond itself.
The Richmond Mall approached my friend and partner, Todd Selfridge, who was the owner of Comics Plus here in Richmond, right off of Big Hill Avenue.
Yep, that's my store.
That's your store?
That's
okay.
My store, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, they approached Todd and said, hey, we'd like to put on a Comic-Con event. Can you help us do this? Mm-hmm. Okay. So Todd and I saw this as an opportunity to really bring something to Richmond.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people go to Lexington. Some people go to, you know, other big cities like Indianapolis, Cincinnati, you know, for conventions. We wanted to bring one here to Richmond. They had the space for it. They provide the venue. We brought in the vendors, the artists, and the guests. So with this, we also wanted to focus on kind of like local talent.
Among that local talent was Lexington's Justin Stewart. Artist on books like Kentucky Kaiju and his own Kickstarter-published comic Bleed Leaders, Stewart was candid about life in the comics industry. It should also be noted that he was drawing a commission of carnivorous Ewoks when approached for comment.
Oh, man. It's up and down as far as, you know, what you can do and how much fun you have. Just like anything else, you know. But it is, you know, super rewarding to be able to create something and have someone respond to it, you know, and certainly, you know, you get a reaction from them, you know, so like visual art is really cool.
Cons are diverse events that draw in people from all sorts of fandoms, niche or mainstream. Charles Bowling, a first-time attendee of a Comic-Con, had one thing on his mind when it came to visiting this one in particular.
I came here to find some Spider-Man memorabilia from the early 2000s.
So like Sam Raimi?
Specifically.
Oh, cool. Is this your first convention?
This is my first convention. I have never been to one before.
So, what do you think about it? Are you enjoying it?
It's different. I didn't expect to see that many people in their costumes of superheroes and Star Wars stuff that they liked. Although, I guess I sort of should have expected it.
Turnout for Rich City was high. Gift is excitedly optimistic about the notion of bringing back the event for a second year.
All the hard work that we put into this has been very rewarding so far. So,
any plans for next year then? Because it looks like you guys are going to get a next year.
We definitely want to have a next year. We've had some conversations about that already. We definitely want to come back next year in Richmond. We've already been talking with some guests for next year. I can't say who those are yet. Mm-hmm. But next year, we want to bring in some guests who have a little bit more name recognition, mm-hmm. while also not forgetting the people who are here this year and supported us, bring them back next year. But the plan is to definitely come back next year, hopefully make it bigger, but definitely accessible to anyone and everyone.
For Eastern Standard, I am Eastern Progress opinion editor Blake Vickers.
We're going to take a break next week to spend time with family and friends on Thanksgiving. We'll be back on November 29th with a question.
Hey, what's in that cup?
It's just some water.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, it's not soda. You want to try some?
You know what? Sure. Hand me a sip.
I have a cup.
Of what?
It's water.
I have a cup.
Coming up on the next Eastern Standard, Thursday, November 29th. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer. Colin Overton is our intern. Eastern Standard content partnerships and other information about us can be found online at esweku.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.